Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
The Mian Team.
With guest co-hosts...
Raph Hive.
Try Goodfellow.
Frog 3 said in the response to the latest Polycast episode that Mackie should speak more. I think Mackie should do the countdown.
That's right.
Oh, that works. He doesn't get to hear it. Ha ha ha.
There's always a first time. Oh. No pressure.
Oh, you already started the backup, didn't you?
Maybe.
I thought so. 3, 2, 1, shiny.
If you had a chance to listen to the latest episode or seen the Polycast website lately, you would have learned that Cartamandua is no longer a regular co-host on the show. She has agreed to be a guest, but due to real life circumstances can't be a regular anymore. And I said that we were looking for a new fourth regular co-host, and we found that person. It's the Mian Team.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 76. For As For Me, your newest co-host, the Mian Team, I'm here, and I'm introducing you to Daniel Quick.
And you have done so.
Makalua.
Hello.
Rough Eye.
Welcome aboard.
And Troy Goodfellow.
Hello, everyone.
In Forum Talk, we talked about a cute little bug, not, in 3.19 with an infinite tech tree with liberalism and Oracle, about whether you would consider civilization violent, more uses for bomber support, whether Praetorians are overpowered or not, and should attack and defense ratios come back for Civ 5. This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
One nine infinite free tech with liberalism. This, unfortunately, as a bug, crossed over into 3.19, and unlike the old one that was passed from 3.19, it lets you basically keep taking free text with liberalism without reloading. You have to time it perfectly by right-clicking and left-clicking the mouse to open the Civilpedia as you're selecting your free tech. But essentially, that would allow you to go through the entire tech tree with either the Oracle or Liberalism. And because it doesn't involve reloads, it's potentially a serious problem in competitive play.
Yeah, I saw that mentioned in the Hall of Fame. We've just launched a new Hall of Fame mod, Buffy, and it was mentioned. So I know people are currently looking at it, not sure about what the fix is, actually.
Was this something that was introduced as a result of 3.19, or it just happened to be that after 3.19's release, someone came across it? I wasn't quite clear on that.
I don't know if anybody knows for sure whether it was around before 3.19 or not. Like, I have not seen that documented. And actually, I was one of the people who dragged this over to Hall of Fame and the Game of the Month series to call it to their attention immediately. Their staff actually handled it very well and very quickly, and it's now officially banned in both of those. It could still be a big problem for multiplayer, though, especially if you're not playing with people you know and trust.
So how did they ban it? They just said don't do it and wagged their finger at people?
Yeah, but they can detect it to an extent, too. Like, for example, Game of the Month asks you to, if you're building the Oracle, to save it before and after you build the Oracle, you know, just to make sure that tech trades are not confused with scraping up some free text and trying to hide it. I think Hall of Fame is a little bit better about it. But, you know, I don't know their detection methods, and that's the way it's supposed to be. You're not supposed to know their detection methods, or else people will find a way to get around them.
Yeah.
Are they required to do that? Is there some mechanism where if they don't do that, then, if you built the Oracle and you didn't document it, so now you're discounted? Or is it more informal than that?
It's more informal, because even though the game's only been out for a few days, some people, well, not like myself, even though I haven't played it yet, could have already started and finished the game. There's nothing they could do about that. But I think they will be a little bit more strict about the people who haven't played the game or hadn't played the game yet to that point and not making the saves. And again, you could just choose not to build Oracle, then you wouldn't need to do it.
Yeah, but the Hall of Fame mod, that's what they use for Game of the Month. It does record, or it does have a log of the texts as you discover them. So you see it in the logs, it says you've completed the Oracle. And then if it says you've now discovered 58 texts, it's going to be a bit of a giveaway.
Well, yeah. But, you know, the more savvy cheaters will probably just free tech things from the Oracle that they could trade for on that turn.
Right, two or three texts or something.
Yeah.
Right.
It's still an advantage, especially in a format like Hall of Fame or Game of the Month, where every turn counts so much, to just suddenly get three or four techs.
You know, my big question is, how do you even discover a bug like this?
Well, that's the other thing. Someone does.
Every time I read one of these game-breaking bugs that seems to require some sort of outside-the-box third-brain thinking, I'm wondering, who's the guy clicking both mouse buttons and realizing he can do it forever?
And then reporting it. I mean, if you find this bug, don't you keep it to yourself?
Well, some geeks are honest geeks.
Hey, maybe, you know, he's making an honest attempt to make sure that it's balanced so that, you know, everyone's aware of the bug rather than just a couple people. And I think it's not surprising that bugs are discovered when you have thousands of people playing something. Someone's going to accidentally click, or, you know, maybe he dropped his hand on the mouse or something, and it gave him a free tech, and he could still select free tech. So, like, oh, what's this? When you have a lot of people doing it, just the craziest random things could wind up to leading them finding out about the bugs.
He said he found this bug while playing the Charlemagne scenario, and then after he found it in there, he wanted to see if it would work in Beyond the Sword proper and tried it with a normal game. We thank this user, Plastics, for bringing this to the community's attention, and even though it may not be patched in the future, some people said, oh, there's not going to be an official patch for this. Well, nobody thought there was going to be a 3.19, and boom. But even if there isn't, I'm sure there'll be some sort of informal patch that someone will be working on if they aren't working on it already.
I would be surprised if Buffy didn't patch it, and I would be surprised if the unofficial patch didn't patch it either.
At some point, it's possible that you'll come across the temptation or the opportunity to take advantage of this bug if you are aware of it.
So I shouldn't try this when we play tonight?
I'm going to.
You are both on notice. I'm watching you.
We'll make it a team game.
My team gets the Oracle first, and then, you know, I can't make any promises.
So we start tonight, and there's a massive beeline to Priesthood. Yeah.
Oh, no, here's the solution. Let's just remove Oracle from the game, and no more liberalism tech.
Yeah, we could do that. That would work.
I actually wouldn't have complaints about that, because the liberalism path is so favored already, just because of its trade opportunities while in single player.
Or you could keep it on the tech tree, and if someone researches liberalism, it takes the tech away, if you're the first person.
How do you really need meditation? Once you have liberalism, it can take away that.
There you go.
Yeah, you lose a 68 beacon tech. Woohoo!
Would you consider civilization, quote-unquote, violent? As Amy and Beatles says, recently I went with my mom to put Civilization 4 Complete on layaway at Walmart. I noticed a weird buzzer went off and asked, you know, what that was about, and the cashier said, it's because you have to be at least 17 to buy the game. It's a good thing that my mom was there, and the irony of it is that the game is supposed to be a present for my 17th birthday, which is on September 3rd. So I've been thinking, would you consider civilization violent? Sure, there's battles in it, but if you kill someone, they basically just fall down and melt into the ground. Nothing like some games I've seen the 8-year-old neighbor playing. My mom sent me down to get something that they borrowed.
It sounds to me like the Walmart clerk's an idiot, because this is an E10 game. This is not a 17-plus game. I don't know why the buzzer would have went off, and they'll clearly there's something wrong with the buzzer. I mean, they have to respond to the buzzer, I know that, but it's an E10 game.
Okay, but is Civ 4 violent? That's the question. Yes? No? A little?
Yes. It's violent.
All relative.
Yeah, but it's more in, crap, I don't know how to put it.
Well, it's an abstract strategy game violent.
Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for.
War game violence.
I'm not sure that's right. I mean, I would have categorized it as more a strategic violence instead of a tactical violence. Like, a tactical violence is a punch in the nose, but a strategic violence is when you cut someone off. How many times has Genghis Khan come and backstabbed you just as you're about to backstab him? Now, that's violent.
Yeah, I can see that. I also think abstract, but I think abstract in terms of how it's represented on screen.
Yeah, I think I checked that option which says quick combat about on my third day of playing Civ 4, so I haven't actually seen any violence in my wars for decades.
Yeah, when you defeat a unit, there's not a bloody mess on that tile or a pile of bodies or something. It just kind of goes, whoop, fades away.
Yeah, gone.
Unless you're playing, what is it, the Fall from Heaven mod where they've got blood spray or something?
Yeah. Then
okay, but we're talking about basic Civ 4. We're not talking about mods.
Yeah, people can mod anything they want in. Yes, and unlike a first-person shooter, where the goal is, at least in the process, killing people, killing representations of people or what have you, in Civ 4 you could go a totally peaceful route, rather by chance or even by design in the game setup. So violence isn't a guarantee, even.
Right. In fact, my wife hated the idea of war. The idea of going to war was just completely alien to her when she started playing Civilization. She wanted to be a peaceful, cultural, diplomatic victory spaceship type person. She wanted to be, you know, the Federation, I guess, in Star Trek. And then the Russians came knocking on her door, and that went out the window, so her violent energies were channeled. Even if you don't choose violence, violence sometimes chooses you.
Yeah, like the Dominion turns up on your doorstep.
Yes.
The discussion turned even more into that and started getting into discussions of morality and, of course, the fact about it being violent and the impact of violence in computer gaming and video gaming in general on children, and that argument being that a child will try to imitate something that they see in a first-person shooter, which is more a problem because it's something that was some planning and particular access they could pull off, whereas going for a world domination or conquest would be a little bit more difficult for them to practice in real life.
I mean, unless their parents are dictators in a third world country, but...
It's a little scarier if they successfully attempt the world conquest or domination, I think they're going to say. I don't know, some people went a little ballistic on Walmart, and of course it makes me wonder if it was just this particular cashier, this particular store, Walmart in general.
Dan, you've got to also factor in that this Walmart's in Canada, so it just could be the Canadian angle.
She did raise that herself. She says, you know, I'm in Canada, so I'm not sure if that's anything to do with the ESRB. Well, it does. We're enforced to abide by the rating. Most retailers do so voluntarily anyway, and that's been my experience too.
It's the same in the U.S. The ESRB has the same regulations in Canada and the U.S. It's voluntary. And most retailers, they've paid more attention to ESRB ratings in the last couple of years. I've been very impressed with even GameStop clerks, for God's sakes, asking good questions of people trying to buy ESRB products outside of the age range, which I hadn't seen like 5 years ago, but in the last couple of years, so I've been quite impressed. But Walmart, I mean, this isn't a specialty store, so they're not going to pay much attention to the ratings, I suspect. They're just going to trust the little beeping buzzer.
The first thing that came to my mind when I saw this was, you know how they stamped these stickers on the boxes? They probably just put the wrong sticker on without realizing it.
When the buzzer goes off, the cashier really doesn't have any choice. They're trained now after, you know, how many different 2020 exposés of people selling Grand Theft Auto to three-year-olds. You know, when the buzzer goes off, you know, they have to ask for ID. I mean, that's part of their training now. If you go to a Walmart, you're not going to see a lot of gamers or tech experts in their media division. They just sell what's on the shelf, by and large. So I don't really want to fault the clerk too much if the buzzer went off. I mean, I think, yeah, a mislabeled box probably makes sense. Because this is not a 17-plus game. This is not an M-rated game.
If the cashier in this story would like to call into the show and tell...
somehow I'm guessing they don't listen to this.
For me, it is of interest and it's not of interest, partially because my games usually don't go that long, so I don't often think about this issue, but it's an important issue enough. You know, some people like to start in later eras, or some people like to do advanced starts in later eras.
Or some people just aren't that good. I often get to the oil level.
I've actually found that the AI is better at bomber attacks than I am. It seems I always get to that stage, and when I start a war, they fly all these bombers over and just decimate my improvements, and I realize, well, why didn't I do that? At the moment, I'm trying to watch what the AI does and learn from them, which is probably not the right way to do it, but...
Well, to me, the most annoying thing about bombers is that they're so easily intercepted, and they come later than fighters. Going back to the flight is the most important check, whatever thread, may or may not be true, but when you have fighters, you can have a lot of fighters, like infinite fighters if you are launching them off carriers. Whereas with bombers, you're limited to your cities. And if you're using bombers, then if your opponent is also using their capacity and fighters, you're never going to get through interceptions without using your own naval-based fighters. And if you have enough fighters, they essentially take over that role anyway. It's rare that I find that if there's a good balance that really makes good use of bombers. As a lot of posters pointed out, really the best way to use them is to eat up all the interceptions with something else, usually fighters, and then go through with the bombers. But at what point are you better off just making more fighters? Because you're going to need a massive them anyway for every single time you try to use your bombers. And to go all the way through radio just to get that, I'm not convinced that they're all that great. They're pretty good when you have a major tech lead, but to get to bombers before they get anything like flight or even other random interception units is pretty rare in my experience when playing a difficulty level that's really at the level that I'm playing at.
Yeah, when I get that far, it always seems about the time I start rolling fighters and bombers off the production line, that's about the time they get the SAM infantry.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's much easier to get to SAM infantry or even just anti-tanks, which with promotions can intercept 50%. Those come way sooner than flight and definitely sooner than radio and flight put together and combustion since you need oil.
But isn't that the same with all Civ 4 units? Like axes become before swords? Grenadiers come before riflemen?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's pronounced in this case, I guess.
I find that the AI tends to cut road links to cities pretty well with bombers and fighters, and hence isolates cities that then it then tries to attack, which you can't reinforce quickly. That's one of the things that I've been trying to do, to pick off cities that way. I mean, they still get intercepted, but yeah, you just need a truckload of bombers and fighters.
Yeah, I've done that before. I've only done it with the fighters, though. I'm assuming bombers have a slightly higher pillage rate for tile improvements, but fighters are pretty consistent about it, too, actually. The whole carrier-based fighter squad is probably the most typical thing I use there, because that's also good for getting a beachhead when you invade on another continent. Even if they have railroads, you can cut off their ability to reinforce that city, and then you can have your own siege initiative. It's just, AI is stupid, too. It'll move right onto that unroaded tile and just wait for you to just destroy it with siege on the initiative.
Yeah, I don't think bombers have any better chance of destroying tile improvements than fighters do. But then despite my initial poo-pooing about this later part of the game to the point where you can build air units, you have fighters coming earlier, fighters being cheaper, fighters having a chance to intercept enemy aircraft. I almost always build fighters at the almost, if not complete, exclusion of the bombers, with the exception of, as is already said, considerable tech disparity where I'm not much farther ahead. You're sure you're going to lose your fighters, but it's less likely that you're going to lose your fighters as compared to your bombers, and I just find that it's a better bang for your hammer.
Do we want to talk about the specific suggestions in that thread, which is, let's make it all more complicated?
No.
No, as in you don't want to talk about it, or no, you don't want to make it more complicated?
Oh, you both. As fighters, which he's put on patrol, and then he wants to run bombing runs out of his city, and he wants those patrol fighters to go along with his bombers to provide coverage, I don't see that happening. But I think someone down in the thread talked about his fighter versus fighter battles being resolved first and said you could actually set that up manually by clicking on a fighter and then right-clicking on a city, and you'll get a fighter v fighter battle, which will hopefully take down the opposition and allow your bombers free reign.
Yeah, anytime a ground unit goes, it uses up an interception chance. But fighters can intercept infinitely, but only at full health. So if you damage the enemy fighters or destroy them, then they can't intercept you. And you can just do those battles first until it's either, the enemy fighters are so weak that they can't intercept you or they're just not there anymore. Then you can go in with your bombers, or even if the interception chance is really low. But yeah, I don't know about the patrol and then go in there. That's at a tactical level. That'd be the same thing as, like, taking your mounted units in the early game and flanking them manually. Like, it was an RTS or something, as opposed to more like traditional Civ.
To be honest, I don't mind the fighter-bomber situation at the moment. Effectively, it's saying that you need to control the skies, which everybody knows from actual battles is pretty much true.
That's if you want to use bombers.
Well, how else? Okay, if you don't use bombers, how are you going to bombard city defenses down to zero before you send in your troops? Or are you not going to do that and just have high casualties?
Well, what I usually do is just have rows of infantry and artillery with a couple anti-tanks thrown in. We get the job done very easily.
And one tile at a time, stepping into the opposition's territory?
Yeah, but I don't really stop to heal ever. because you have a large stack. So after you bombard and take a city, the guys who don't attack can sit there and heal for a turn. And if you have a good medic unit, essentially you're on a forced march through their territory without ever stopping.
And it was mentioned about having, just to tie it to an earlier part of this conversation, carriers with fighters on them. And you could also think, it was you who pointed out in the thread, Tim, about forts being able to carry.
Yeah, I think forts can carry four fighters or four airborne units as well.
Yep.
And I played a game, we put down a city that had enough food to live, but it had like five or six desert tiles around it. And I was thinking, what am I going to do with all these desert tiles? Lo and behold, I throw up forts, and this one city, I can have something like, 24 fighters or 24 bombers just sitting there. It was pretty powerful. You just got to make sure that if you've got four fighters in a fort, they can just turn up, sit on the fort, and you just lose four fighters just like that. So stick some sort of ground unit to provide some sort of protection.
That's especially true if you're using friendly civilizations as bases for air units, too.
Yeah.
You can do that, and it's often very effective, but you don't want to just leave them there, especially if they have open borders. Your enemy has open borders. They'll just walk in there from any distance without any trouble and kill all your fighters. But if it is closed borders, then it's just hilarious because they can't even go in there.
I was in a situation with that in another play-by-email game, and I ended up talking the guy into opening borders, and then I was able to kill off, I think, four fighters with an archer. I posted that in funny pictures. It was really funny. Your archer has defeated a fighter.
Not just one, either. Took out an army of fighters.
Poll. I chose this thread because of the alliteration in the title. I don't care about anything else in the thread. That's the only reason I... No. Fungus420 thinks that, from his view, the Praetorian is ridiculously overpowered. It's just common sense. It has no counter, and nothing beats it until 1v1, until crossbows. No other unit is like this in Civ 4, except the battleship, which everyone can build. But there seems to be a big debate on this, so I wanted to know the opinions of others. Maybe it's the teacher in me, I don't know, but I like this part about, without the guise of asking a definition of overpowered, just see it as on common sense terms. Okay. I guess we could try not to have a definition of overpowered, but that does make the conversation a little bit difficult, trying to have some kind of ground rules here.
Well, especially since he defines overpowered, it has no counter and nothing beats it. That's how he defines overpowered.
That's true.
Well, okay, I'm going to argue with that definition, because if you are Rome, then you can pretty much dominate in the early part. But if you're facing Rome, there are counters. You put an axe in a forest,
yep.
Or if you catch a Praetorian by himself out in the open with an axe, you've got a pretty good chance of taking him down. It's like 7.5 versus 8 in strength.
Not to mention that many of the protective civs with their archers are certainly even to a Praetorian in many situations, especially if it's on a hill with a wall.
Without cats.
Yep. The Native Americans with a totem pole and archers on a hill behind a wall, it'll take quite a few Praetorians to do some damage.
Now, there's an overpowered building.
Promotion for the archer, that is awesome.
Relative choke archers, fun times.
So, certain civs have counters in certain situations. Is the Praetorian very strong? Yeah. A lot of other units have been nerfed. Cossack was overpowered, and it was nerfed. The Praetorian has somehow escaped any weakening, but you can find a way around it. A lot of it is using the terrain you have and making sure the Romans don't get iron.
Before the game hit the shelves, Rome was apparently an aggressive civilization with the aggressive trait, which means your prets came out with combat 1 automatically.
Oh.
That was removed during game testing.
Can't imagine why.
But that's one of the fun things, that you play with unrestricted leaders and you play an aggressive civ as Rome.
You know, it's possible that you'll come across Rome in your travels after they've already gotten themselves iron and it's mined and king, and they've been able to build Praetorians. They're 8 strength instead of 6. They cost a little bit more than swordsmen. They don't have the city attack benefit. I realize it's only 10%. But as I said, there are counters for it. Can be a pain in the butt, certainly if there's volume of them. But if you prepare yourself for it, if you know you're near Rome, you can start strategizing and getting yourself into a position so that you can counter them. And it's possible that you can get dogpiled by them and lose a city, but build up properly again, and maybe you have to expand a little more somewhere else, do a little bit rebuilding, you can go and take it back.
Yeah.
Or you can make them your friend. If I'm facing the Romans, I will, you know, suck up to them. I will spread my religion or accept theirs.
And point them to another civ to attack. I don't mind facing Rome. If you were facing Montezuma and he had Praetorians, then that would be overpowered.
Yes.
You know he's going to attack and you know he's going to come with this unbeatable unit. Game over. But it's Jesu.
At least you can negotiate with Caesar.
Especially Augustus Caesar. He doesn't even declare it pleased. Only Julius Caesar will declare it pleased. And Augustus Caesar has a low unit prob, too. So, really, he's pretty benign if you start near Augustus. Julius can be a problem, though. Depending on where you spawn relative to the other civilizations, if you're talking about AIs, Julius can actually be a threat. Like, if you get catty-cornered on two civs that aren't very friendly or something like that. But generally speaking, they're not the worst to manage in terms of diplomacy. But I'm going to go the other way on this in terms of their balance. Like, I have a much more lax definition before something needs to be overpowered. For example, Zerg early in StarCraft or anything else, it doesn't need to be so hard to beat that you can't beat it normally. It just has to be strong enough that it has a clear advantage over everything else in terms of balance. Now, with the Praetorians, actually axes do beat them on a hammer-for-hammer basis, even if they're not aggressive axes. But when you have focused military, the Praetorians are going to take less losses, and that's a problem. My issue with Praetorians is not necessarily their strength, but how much better they are as unique units over almost every other unique unit in the game. I would like to either see the other unique units brought up to the Praetorian level so that each civ has a unique flavor and strength in its own era, or the Praetorians scale back a little bit, along with possibly Immortals and the other really top-tier unique units, and maybe see the Keycha rework entirely so that it's actually usable in multiplayer and that it's not just overwhelming in single-player. But the Praetorians definitely feel strong relative to the vast majority of regular unique units. And I understand that there's going to be a strongest unique unit, but these guys just feel like they're such a notch above every other unique unit. They feel like vanilla redcoats or Cossacks.
Yeah, I mean, probably the best thing would be to raise the weaker unique units, like the Kinkechua and the Holkan, the early Stone Age units, which are obsolete very quickly. Find a way to make them more useful, and as well as the other unique units, instead of nerfing the Praetorians. I think you're right. Bring everyone up to that level, or at least close to it.
And I would argue, actually, just knocking the Praetorians down a little bit. I'm not sure that needs to be done, either. In this poll, I voted a top-tier unique unit, nothing more.
Me too.
I would think that if you decided, okay, we need to do something with the Praetorian, do something with the Praetorian, but leave the other units the way they are. There's less balancing to have to worry about in trying to change one thing on the Praetorian or change a couple things on the Praetorian rather than trying to get all the other unique units or even units in general to that quote-unquote level. Along that line, Carrick suggested making them 7 strength instead of 8 and giving them the 10% city attack bonus back.
So it makes them 7.7 attacking cities instead of 8.
That's what it would boil down to.
That's basically the same in my book.
Well, it's a little different just because of the way combat works. When you have bonuses like that, they're reduced from the defender instead of adding to the attacker. And that does make a difference sometimes. For example, on occasion, depending on the percentage defense, combat actually is more effective towards your chances of winning than City Raider on Praetorians, well, on any unit. So it's not quite the same. But when you make that change, it makes it so that Praetorians are not so overpowering in the field. They would get cut down by axes really easily. You would need some degree of stack balance or at least intelligent movement through enemy territory to offset that.
Alternatively, Behav suggested reduce strength to 6, which is a standard swordsman, give them plus 20% versus city attack and the free combat 1 promotion.
I don't know if I like that as much. I would still like to see them be good in the field because in reality they were, and that helps to contribute to them being a good unique unit. And I don't like how they can easily overpower their counter units. Even crossbows on a hammer-for-hammer basis, Praetorians are better. But I don't know about cutting into the 6 strength, because then they turn into a sort of a weak unique unit, since basic swords are not that great in a lot of situations.
Right. I like Johnny 5000's post that the problem with the Praetorians is that the rapid expansion means your economy goes down. When I play as the Romans, I have the most trouble keeping my economy going after the rapid expansion from taking over so many cities in a short period of time. That is the drawback to Praetorians.
Well, and I would say that's just a drawback to how you're...
I think that's brilliant. They're just so good, they ruin your economy.
The proper response to that is, oh, poor baby.
Proper response to that is, you need to learn when to stop with Praetorians.
Yes. Too much of anything is not a good thing.
There are ways around that. You can keep going.
Yeah.
You have to plan ahead. You have to have pottery in writing at least, preferably alphabet so you can extort things. And then before you invade, actually, you can turn your slider down and start banking gold, and then just keep it down as you capture cities and cities, and you'll get over 1,000 gold. And even if you're losing 50 a turn, you have time to grow your cities, grow your cottages, and pull yourself out of that. Or use your extorted alphabet or currency, or even if it's alphabet, you can just build research to get the currency or whatever you need before you run out of money and start losing units. It's a timing issue, but if you do that, you can capture like 20 cities straight by the early ADs and not strike.
The other option is you just build your three cities because that's all Rome needs. You churn out Praetorians and you just razz the rest of the world. All your workers do is build roads. Your Praetorians march up the front, kill the city, raise it, move on. You hardly ever go into strike in that situation.
Yeah, you could do that. I guess it would depend to me in terms of map type and other AIs that are in the vicinity. Otherwise, there were some other civs in the vicinity, especially if they weren't in particular war and they were in expansion mode, they could just go in and start filling that up. But you could then say, well, I've got all these Praetorians, so I'll just go in and raise those cities as well and take them out. I'd still rather taking not all the cities, because sometimes, especially with the AI, like, you settled this city here, really? Oh. Maybe it eventually will turn around, but the investment is just going to be ridiculous. It's not worth holding on to.
You also capture resources if you keep cities. And after you have enough resources from all the land you took, even if you have very poor in tech, you can still start trading for the calendar resources too. Just because you have a lot of extra corns or fish or whatever it is after you killed off a couple civs. And you can get your happiness cap up pretty good without having access to any tech that would help that normally. Just because you have a ton of cities, and you either have the luxury resources yourself, or you can trade with them with somebody who you're not invading in the immediate future.
Yeah, did you read that thread about the guy that scored like 800,000 in a Hall of Fame game? It was a mortal large map. He played as Rome and basically went on a blitz at the beginning. And the way he did not crash his economy was by selling all of his resources to all of the other AIs for gold.
I believe that was Virus Monster. Yeah, when I was a newer player, I read that thread pretty carefully, actually.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive.
There's some good information in there. I'd forgotten about that thread.
Yeah.
He also breaks down trade routes and how organized affects your gold and whatever, as opposed to financial. Because Rome is doing mass conquest, it actually wound up being stronger than financial for the majority of his game. But he also has a marathon going on there.
So of the 151 people who have voted in this thread over at CFC, just over half, 55%, have said a top tier. We've heard overpowered, need a nerf balance, that's second at 35%. 8 people have said game-breaking.
1 person says it's too weak.
And 14 people just like voting in polls. Oh, dear.
Should attack and defense ratios be used in Civ 5? Game Master 77. So, I said yes. Separate attack and defense bonuses should be used. But I still think bonuses against different types of units should be used to encourage different types of units instead of 4 or 5 mechanized infantry, modern armor, radar artillery, and stealth bombers, jet fighters sometimes. And then he says subtract 1 from no and add 1 to yes because 1 person messed up. I find it interesting that you chose modern era units in your description, maybe your later age starter and or an advanced starter in combination thereof. So far in this poll, no is winning 12 to 11, and I put myself in the no category.
I voted no. Civ 3, from memory, had attack and defense, and it was just too confusing.
All the Civs had attack and defense until Civ 4.
Well, yeah, when they launched Civ 4, it was one of the things, no more attack and defense. We've now rationalized the system, and there's only one strength, and away we go.
Yeah, in Civ 3, you had a vertical health bar that accompanied every unit in the game, and the length of the bar indicated the overall health of the unit, and it was separated into segments, and you had conscripts and regulars and veterans and elites, where each combat round had a chance of inflicting a single hit point loss on a unit, which is simply a probability based on the relative attack and defense strengths of the combatants. So, as the example on CFC's Civ 3 info page says, if a unit has an attack factor of 9 and attacks a unit with a defense factor of 1, it has a 90% chance of inflicting a hit point loss on it during that round. And so every unit had an attack, as you said, attack, defense, and a move value. Here's a segue to our last topic. Swordsmen had a 3 attack and 2 defense and 1 move, and the Roman legionary had 3 defense along with 3 attack and 1 move. So there was the difference there.
what is the case for having attack and defense ratios? I mean, I think that a lot of the promotions and bonuses really covers a lot of that. Each unit has strength and a weakness against specific types of units. You can customize against units. You think if you're facing gunpowder units, you take the pinch thing. If you're facing siege weapons, you take the anti-siege thing, which I think is much more intuitive and allows you to customize a little bit better. What's the argument in favor of defense ratings, except that it goes back to a traditional mode? Because it's a very close poll. Clearly, some people think that's a good idea.
Yes, now admittedly with 12 to 11, not many people have voted. But yeah, I think that percentage could be consistent even if more people voted in the poll. In terms of the opinion on this, but...
It's apparently now 13 to 11.
Oh, did you just go in and vote Mackie? Okay,
yes. No more attack defense.
I mean, that's what they did with the promotions, effectively. They still have attack defense arbitrage, but they've done it through the promotions. I mean, if you've got a swordsman at City Raid of 3, he's not strength 6, he's effectively strength 12. But when he's defending, he's strength 6.
They also have the built-in abilities for the archers and longbows, where they have implicit city defense.
Yep, they're extra strong defending, not so strong attacking.
Kamikaze was one of the people who voted yes and argued it would definitely help with the whole promotions problem and would lead to a more diversified army, quote-unquote. That was the first sentence. I guess the promotions problem refers to another threat or something. What's the problem?
What promotion problem?
He didn't link to it. It's not referenced, so I don't know. I'm not going to comment.
More diversified army?
Yeah, I was thinking, no, don't you mean would lead to a less diversified army?
Yeah, our armies are pretty diversified right now.
If you've got two archers and you promote one down the combat line, it's equally strong attack and defense. But if you promote one down, say, the city defense line, it's obviously a defending unit. So you've got effectively two archers, which are now actually two different units.
Yeah, with all the different combinations of promotions you can do, you have a pretty diverse army, and not having to think about, oh, is this going to add to the defenses, or is it going to add to the attack, and I like the unified strength number.
Yeah, it's much easier to add depth to the combat system when using promotions as opposed to attack and defenses, because if you were to use the attack and defense ratios, then you would need to build different kinds of archers, ultimately. You would need to build, like, a combat archer and city garrison archer, and you could call them different things or what have you. But it would add a lot of clutter to the game needlessly, I think. Now, the one thing I can say against promotions is that maybe they shouldn't be allowed to be used in enemy territory to heal. Because that's really abusive. I do that a lot. But,
I know nothing about that.
But then you get the question like, okay, I've got this unit that's got a promotion, it'll win at 80% of the time, but if I promote, it'll probably win at 90, but I can save the promotion for when he gets injured. You know, do I take the risk at 80 and then heal him? I mean, I really like the healing option.
Yeah, but once you start adding siege, the cost of attacking unpromoted starts dropping pretty fiercely. And then you just have a full-strength army of stack defenders at all times.
Hmm.
Well, I don't know if everyone knows it, so basically when you promote a unit that's damaged, it heals back half of the health that they're missing, is how that works. So if you have two promotions, you can actually get pretty close to full health in a lot of cases. If you have like a 1-2 or less percent chance of winning that changes between promotions, it's a pretty big draw. Your likelihood of getting damaged is much higher than your likelihood of winning the battle.
As for the diversified army part, the next sentence... Kamikaze says, I think this should come in combination with a wider array of units to choose from. So that is consistent with his part about wanting to go back to attack defense, because as was said, you can have a diversified army not only in the types of units, so not just, you know, melee, mounted, and siege, but you've also got diversity in individual units with the promotion line. But if you don't do that, then to get those, otherwise to have those options, then you have to have more units, a wider array of units, and I don't think we need more units.
No, let's not do that. The other thing I like about the promotion angle instead of the attack defense is you can make promotions, like if you go from a melee unit to a gunpowder unit, straight away you've made all those units that you've been fighting with anti-melee promotion, you've made that promotion worthless. You could attack with a mace and they had plus 25% against you, but you turn around and attack with a musketman, plus one strength, goes from 8 to 9, but now that plus 25 defending against a melee unit, that promotion just goes away. I suppose what I'm saying is I like the ability to invalidate a whole lot of AI's promotions.
Yeah, Trunonian. I like the current system, seems more realistic, it leads to a more combined arms approach. Yes. But Game Master 77 says, I don't think so. This prevents people from attacking a city, capturing it, moving in, and keeping it. You then have to bring defenders also. Yes, exactly. Your more diversified
basic
army.
Tactics? Leave the units you need to heal in that city? That's another one.
You mean I have to build longbows? So who builds longbows?
Oh, I can't have an Uber unit that does anything and everything in every possible situation?
Sure you can. Praetorian.
No.
So he says, if both are used, it would encourage more units, so you have defensive units of every type and offensive units of every type. That's... Why would I want have to have more of every type? I like having the diversity, but I don't have to bring everything but the kitchen sink, and I can't just have one type of unit most of the time. So, I don't know which way this guy's going. Actually, that was the most frequent discussion, was between the username that starts with T, GameMaster77, and they go back and forth. Mentioned the rapier is a spear, whether you're attacking or defending, it still functions the same.
No, that's not right.
No, I don't agree either. And then Game Master 77 says, when a spear is defending, it would keep its shield close to its body, and jab as the enemy comes near. When attacking, it would charge, keeping the shield at a distance, most likely using the spear as a lance-type weapon. And the response to that was individually, but Civ is on a much larger scale. A unit of spears serves the same purpose when attacking as it does when defending.
No.
No.
Exactly, but it's true that when you have armies of spears, it functions very differently from one person with a spear. You just get rows of those, and part of their advantage was the fact that people standing behind the very front row could still strike the enemy in spear formations. It was very difficult to actually break into them. It's not identical if they're moving forward versus not moving.
It's very difficult to ride through a lot of spears unless you're Gandalf the White in the Two Towers when he steams down that hill into the orcs.
Well, I mean, when you have magic, sure.
When you have magic, basic strategy's out the window.
That's probably also for Fall from Heaven rather than basic support.
And the thing is, the comment about a unit of spears serves the same purpose when attacking as it does when defending, that comment came from the person who likes the current system. So I found myself agreeing with, yes, I like the current system too, but I found disagreeing with points that he was making, which was kind of interesting.
The other thing he doesn't point out is, are they attacking or defending against tanks?
Yeah, because then all bets are off.
This had to get mentioned. It's fast.
So then Kamikaze, who was the person who said, no, we should go back to attack defense. At least their discussion has ended with, I think there's a general assumption that a unit comprises both the offensive and defensive aspects of what would normally comprise a military unit.
Uh-huh.
But still, some units are always going to be stronger in attack than in defense, so this should probably be represented. But it is!
That is.
Yes, it is.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY. You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Montcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
You have been listening to episode 76 of Polycast. Thank you to Makalua.
Bye.
Philip Bellew.
Crashing the co-host panel at last.
Tim Ruffy Pratt.
Thanks, guys. Was fun.
Daniel Quick, the host and maestro.
Yes, I do thank me.
And I am Troy Goodfellow, and I was happy to be here today.
If you were invited to come back onto the show, would you? Wow, that's...
That was a question, Troy. That was a question.
Well, yes. Was I... What was the question?
I have a segue here. An archer walking in and taking out your fighters sounds overpowered. Speaking of overpowered, I don't know, that was so forced.
really, Dan? I couldn't tell that was forced.
Not me, I'm investing in culture.
You know who we're declaring war on next?
Or we could just say the entire game is overpowered and nobody should play it.
Well, it is. I mean, it's so much better than so many other games that it's just not fair. I don't know what to say at this point, to be honest.
Welcome to the show.
Record date?
August 22nd, 2009.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright 2009, Civilized Communication at civcom.net.